Welcome back, everybody, for the 7th episode of The Bronx Beat. My name is Ryan Garcia. I'm joined by Gary Phillips, as always, beat writer for the New York Daily News, covering the New York Yankees. We've got some stuff to discuss as spring training games have kicked off. There are some interesting notes around spring training and some small things we'll discuss in terms of mechanical things or pitch changes or things of that nature. We'll get into that kind of stuff. Jose Caballero, how he fits into the shortstop equation. Will Warren and some things he's changing. Jake Bird's new pitch and the bullpen race in general. We'll talk some ABS, all that and more right here on Fireside Yankees. If you like this kind of content, make sure you like, subscribe, turn on that notification bell, and you can support the channel by also checking out our social media pages. Links to everything will be in the description. But before we get into any baseball talk, Gary, how are we doing, man? How are we feeling?
I'm doing good. I'm actually not feeling 100% myself. There's been a little bug or cold going around the Yankees beat here. So if my voice sounds a little grovelly or, you know, scratchy, that is why. I'm feeling fine physically, just a little congested, a little bit of a scratchy throat. Been getting through it the last couple days, but just got back from Dunedin, where the Yankees are playing the Blue Jays today, and ready to go. Give it my best effort here.
I can't imagine it would be any better for you up here in the Northeast. We just got destroyed by 2 feet of snow. So I spent approximately 1 hour shoveling outside and came back in and already started building up a cough. So I'm very envious of you. Last week I was, who cares? And now we're crushed by snow. I don't think I'm gonna be leaving my house for another 24 hours probably, and we'll keep it going from there. But we've got some stuff to talk about with the shortstop position, because Jose Caballero kind of started the first few games of spring training and had a bang. He had a 400-foot home run to left field in the home opener, I believe it was, against the Tigers. He made some changes over the offseason working at Driveline. He talked about some goals. Can you kind of talk to us a little bit about what Jose Caballero is doing differently, some of the things he's been working on over the course of this winter?
Yeah, so he did spend some time at Driveline, as you mentioned. I know The Athletic's Brennan Cuddy wrote a story about that the other day. I talked to Jose about his time at Driveline as well. And, he was just saying essentially like he was focused on his swing path and increasing his bat speed, which is something he already did a little bit last year. He started working with them two off seasons ago, went back this past off season, and just wants to increase his bat speed a little bit. He found some success doing that with Driveline this past season, splitting time between the Rays and the Yankees, and he's hoping to kind of tick that up a few notches again this coming season. He's got this opportunity coming up now where he's going to be the expected starting shortstop, at least while Anthony Volpe is out, and maybe gets a little bit of runway to latch onto that job. I'm a little skeptical whether he's going to have an earnest shot at doing that. But yes, those are some of the tweaks he's made, some of the things he's worked on over the offseason. And he talked a little bit about wanting to have a little more power without necessarily trying to be a power hitter.
Yeah, and for context, Jose Caballero last season was in the 9th percentile in hard hit rate, the 23rd percentile in barrel rate. His bat speed of 69.1 miles per hour was firmly below average. He has not traditionally been somebody who hits the ball hard. Actually, he's never really had any even like league average-ish batted ball data. So I do wonder if we do see an uptick in the power. But Gary, you kind of talked a little bit about the shortstop job and him having it early in the year, but being skeptical that he'll have a chance to win it throughout the course of the year. Why do you feel as if Jose Caballero may not be a high probability guy to steal Volpe's job at this point in time?
I'm basing that on the way that the Yankees have talked about these two players. I want to throw in the caveat here that obviously things can change. Caballero can play exceptionally well, during this period where Volpe's out. Volpe could come back and, be what he's been offensively for the last three seasons, which isn't very good. And, maybe the Yankees reconsider some things again. But when it comes to Volpe, the Yankees have staunchly defended him at every single turn. You had Brian Cashman last year saying, he thinks he's going to be part of the solution, not the problem per se. And then when it comes to Caballero, Boone always talks about him bringing value off the bench because of his versatility, his speed, hitting from the right side. So that came up again the other day when, Caballero homered, and it's just, it's kind of tough to ignore, you know, every time this guy gets talked about. And by the way, Boone's a huge fan of him. I mean, speaks of him, you know, in glowing terms, talked about how he has this great confidence and thinks he's, you know, how Jose thinks he's the best player on the field whenever he steps out there. Like, Boone's not saying this in a critical way of Caballero necessarily, but in an indicative way of, I think, the role that the Yankees best view him in as. And you know, Boone's used the word, you know, the phrase 10th man when describing Caballero. He said he brings unique versatility off the bench. So that came up again the other day, and I just thought that was notable because, you know, now we're talking about Caballero in this context where he's going to get a month, give or take, of unimpeded runway. And it's like, okay, we're still making sure to throw out these caveats whenever we talk about him.
Yeah, and I do wonder how the course of the season could change things. Again, I don't think this is a closed door necessarily, but it, as you mentioned, Anthony Volpe is going to get every chance to prove that he is the shortstop that the Yankees believe him to be. They still view him highly, and there are going to be cases of guys being hurt in the everyday lineup. I know last year, Josh Chisholm missed most of, if not all of May with an injury. Totally possible Caballero has to fill in at second base. It's possible that Volpe needs more time. It's possible that McMahon or Rosario get banged up, or that there's an outfield injury and Caballero steps in to play some corners. So I do think there'll be at-bats and plate appearances for him even when Volpe is back, but it seems like it's Volpe's job to lose until he loses it, or he, yeah, if he plays poorly, I imagine maybe he'll lose it.
I think that is the safe assumption, or maybe the betting assumption that I would make right now. Look, Caballero could come out of the gate and hit 340 over, you know, the first month of the season, or, you know, between now and when Volpe gets back, you know, steals a bunch of bases, gets on base at the clip that he did last year after the trade, and it's like, okay, wait, we have, you know, the Yankees have something to really consider here and think about. Anything short of him setting the world on fire, I think I would bet that Volpe is going to get the job back when he comes back.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things where the Yankees like Volpe. They'll want to prove whether that theory is right or wrong, and we'll see. I'm sure if, you know, Volpe has a 530 OPS over the first 2 months of the season, the conversation's going to come up, and it's going to be an unavoidable one. There are instances where they'll say, hey, this guy's not going to see less playing time or reduced playing time, and then it happens. I mean, things can change over the course of 162, the urgency of games, how far back they are of the standings, how far ahead they are in the standings. I think there's a lot of variables we don't know yet, and that'll ultimately determine how we look back on this conversation and how we look at the shortstop position. Any final thoughts on Caballero and the shortstop position in general?
Yeah, just to be clear, like, I expect him, Caballero, that is, to play a lot for the Yankees. Not necessarily to take the stranglehold on the shortstop position, you know, fair or not, but I do expect him to play a lot. And also, like, we briefly mentioned him hitting for more power. I'm not sure if people realize, like, he hits bombs in spring, in batting practice. Like, the Yankees have been talking about that since the trade last year. He does have, I think, a little untapped power that, you know, would certainly help his case if he showed a little more of that in games this year.
And for another note here, Jose Caballero in 275 plate appearances with the Rays had 2 home runs and 12 doubles. With the Yankees in 95 plate appearances, 3 home runs, 6 doubles. I know there was a 2-homer game in there somewhere, but there was more game power. His slugging percentage and his game power were better. How sustainable that is, that remains to be seen. Also wanted to note, in terms of his damage rates, which is a stat you can find on this website called The Realist Muto. It's from a writer on Baseball Prospectus named Robert Orr. If you look at his damage percentage year by year, it's a year-over-year increase throughout his career. So in 2023, it was in the 22nd percentile. 2024, slight uptick to the 23rd percentile. First half with the Rays, 34th percentile. And then with the Yankees, 46th percentile. So he went from pretty much comfortably below average in terms of damage rate to right around league average with the Yankees. So I do wonder if maybe there's a little bit more there. And I'm curious to see how this first month of the year kind of goes for Caballero, because it is a pretty interesting first month for him. Another guy who has been fairly interesting to monitor throughout spring training is Will Warren, who had his first outing this past afternoon. He was a rookie starter who made all 33 starts for the Yankees, had some ups, had some downs, but ultimately played a pretty important role on last year's squad. Gary, what are some things that Warren is doing differently in this first outing of spring training?
Yeah, so maybe you didn't notice it. I frankly, myself, didn't quite pick up on it until Will mentioned it himself post-game. But he was working from the third base side of the rubber today at TD Ballpark. Traditionally, Will has always pitched from the first base side of the mound, at least since the Yankees drafted him back in 2021. He said that he did work on the third base side a little bit in college, but you know, since then, it's been all first base side. So why do that? Why make that change? Well, Warren said he believes he's coming from a more healthy attack angle now. He thinks it's going to be a little sharper for righties. It's going to feel like he's coming right at them. For lefties, it might feel like a breaking ball. His sweeper, his curveball is just so far out there that they're going to think it's a ball, and then it drops in the strike zone. So that's something he's working on, something that he thinks is going to help. You know, he's particularly focused on improving his numbers against lefties this coming season. So maybe this is something that does that trick for him and helps him kind of take his step, his game to the next level after, you know, some, I would say, successful rookie season, but also one that included a lot of growing pains.
I'm going to come off like such a dork here, but I'm thrilled to hear that. And the reason I am is because one thing I've always harped on with these East-West pitchers, guys who have these low arm slots and have a very wide release point, very long arms, Michael King, Will Warner, pitchers in that archetype, their pitches play very well when they create, as you mentioned, those sharp angles. We can measure that in horizontal approach angle. And for example, with like a sweeper, so a right-on-right sweeper, if Warren throws it away to a righty, the righty is more likely to swing because he's seeing it from way, way towards like where his back is. So when it sweeps across the plate, you see strike, 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 then it's a ball. They're going to swing, but it's probably going to be a ball. That's a chase. That's a swing and a miss. It works in the inverse for like two-seamers. So if you are a righty seeing a sinker that starts outside and comes back to the first base side of the plate for a called strike, you see ball, 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 and then last second it's a strike. The more towards the third base side you are, the greater that kind of deceptive effect works. So hitters can't really tell where the pitch is going to end up in the zone until it actually ends up there or ends up out of zone. The TLDR is essentially because Warren is such a like lower body, he's so wide in his release, the further he gets to third base, the harder it is for hitters to pick up where the ball is actually going to end up, and they're going to make worse swing decisions. So they're likely going to hit the ball less hard. They're not going to swing at strikes. They're going to swing and miss more often. I've like harped on the fact that Warren does not use that enough, at least early in his career. In 25, that started being a thing he used more. With, if you look at Michael King, he started clicking when he started utilizing that to his benefit. I hope Warren picks that trick up, and that's something he can really lean on, because he's not a power pitcher. He does not have overwhelming velocity. If he hangs it, a hitter will bang it. He does have to be very, like, it has to be deceptive. He has to be very deceptive, and I'm glad to hear this. So that's, like, big pitching nerd stuff, but I've been, like, talking to so many people about this in back channels. Like, I hope this happens one day. I didn't even notice it. I did not notice it either. I don't know if it's the camera angle. I didn't see it, but that's really cool. I think that's sick.
Yeah, the camera angle was a little off today. I also was stuck in an auxiliary booth where we didn't even have a TV or a monitor in front of us. But in the article that I wrote, I did try to do screen grabs of Warren last year on the first base side versus him today on the third base side. The camera angles are not exactly identical, so like it's maybe not the best look, but both screenshots are against right-handed hitters, so you can kind of imagine the difference in what that hitter would see from, like you said, a sweeper, a curveball, and just the different deception that would come with that pitch just from being a little, you know, further to the right of that batter. So it's something he said that he's comfortable with, but still working on, still getting more comfortable with. It sounds like it's going to be something that he implements, but that's, you know, something I guess we'll know more as he makes some appearances the rest of spring training.
Yeah, and to talk a little more about it, and I found a way to kind of simplify what I was trying to explain earlier, because I just, my brain got all excited. I was like, oh shoot, this is like, there's something very niche that I know about this. The best way to describe it is a pitcher wants a hitter to swing at balls and not swing at strikes, right? You want a hitter to think this is a strike and then it ends up a ball, and a hitter to go, oh, that's a ball, and then it ends up a strike. If a guy doesn't swing at a strike, you win. If a guy swings at a ball, you probably win. There's some guys who can hit a ball out of zone for a hit or a home run, but in most cases, those end up in outs or swings and misses. Warren last year was in the 8th percentile in chase rate. Batters never really expanded the zone against him, and he was in the 44th percentile in whiff percentage, so when they did swing, they didn't miss a lot against him. I also want to pick up their swing rates in zone. Yeah, they had a 62% zone swing rate against him. That's a little bit below the major league average, so he does get a good amount of called strikes, but point is, you need more chases. You need guys to expand the zone a little bit to get more outs and to not get hit as hard as he did at times last year, especially against really good competition. Blue Jays, Red Sox, Dodgers all had games against him where they just lit him up in the first inning or two, and that has to get better throughout the course of the 2026 season. But Gary, I thought one thing he did that made him so vital to last year's team was made 33 starts. He led all rookie pitchers in starts. I'm not sure anybody made more than 33 starts last year in all of baseball. Can you talk about why that makes him so important for the 2026 Yankees, who, for lack of better terms, have some question marks about their volume of starts they'll get this year?
Yeah, I mean, he posted last year. I mean, he's one of those guys in the rotation that is coming off a career-high workload. But for a rookie to do that when, you know, he wasn't necessarily even projected to be in the opening day rotation or was maybe going to be right there at the back end of it, I mean, that's really impressive. And I know people look at the ERA and it's a little on the higher side, but go back, look through his season. You know, there's quite a couple clunkers in there, you know, performances that, you know, maybe lasted one or two innings, sometimes even less. On the whole, I thought Warren was pretty good last year, all things considered. His stuff grades out phenomenally, I mean, across the arsenal. So I think there's a lot of room for him to grow this season and to take that next step in his game. I could see him being a really, you know, significant contributor for this team beyond just being reliable, being durable. I mean, he could be a real weapon for the Yankees in 2026.
Yeah, I think, as you put, there are some clunkers in there, but for a good chunk of the year, he was pretty much like a guy who's going to go out there every fifth day, give you a competitive start, very importantly, go out there every fifth day, something that's not a guarantee with a lot of pitchers in this league. There are questions about how many innings Warren can provide you coming off of a career high in innings pitch, but knock on wood, he's had a pretty strong track record with just going out there and taking the ball every fifth or sixth day in the minor league. So hopefully that continues, because the Yankees, I do think, need that kind of reliability in this rotation. There are a lot of guys who, I mean, I'm pretty sure every guy you could argue in this rotation has a pretty fairly, like, hey, I don't know if they can stay healthy for full 162. Before last year, Fried had spent a stint on the IL every single year of his major league career. Heel is obviously very injury prone. Weathers has been very injury prone. Schlittler in this year has already dealt with some back stuff. Last year kind of flew under the radar, but he dealt with some shoulder stuff around the All-Star break. Maybe he would have had to spend some time on the IL if it wasn't coming off of the All-Star break. But again, it's something that Warren hasn't had those, does not have that reputation. Hopefully that remains the case. Any final notes on Warren and what he's potentially looking like for this year?
No, other than just, you know, in talking to him the last 2 years, you know, mostly the last 2 years, I found him to be a pretty perceptive pitcher, a really smart pitcher. He's still young, obviously still has room to grow, still developing. I always try to preach patience with young pitchers. You know, there could certainly be a sophomore slump or some growing pains, you know, continued growing pains this year. But I think he's a guy who has the talent and the tools to be a really good big league starter.
And the Yankees seemed to think highly of him. I remember even during the 24 season, he was getting smacked around in AAA, and then he came up and got smacked around in the big leagues. The Yankees continued to be pretty confident that he could be a quality big league starter. And the guy I kind of point to as my, hey, if things go right for Warren, this is the guy I kind of model the success after. It's not actually Michael King, but it is another Yankee. Clark Schmidt, his first year in 2023, he had a 4.64 ERA. First year as a starter, 4.64 ERA. 4.42 FIP, made 32 starts, 33 total appearances. Warren this past year, 4.44 ERA, 4.07 FIP, similar situation where he just made all the starts. He was durable. He did what he had to do. Sometimes these learning years, we just get smacked around a little bit early in the year, can be really useful for a pitcher. Getting beat up, it can be helpful. Like, failing can help you learn, all right, this is how my stuff plays against big leaguers. How can we make it play better after that? Obviously, Schmidt has dealt with a lot of injuries since, but when he was healthy, he was pitching pretty well the last 2 years. So not sure you're going to get the same outcome. As Gary, you noted, it's possible that he takes a step back. It's possible, you know, he could get hurt. I mean, he's a pitcher still at the end of the day. But I do think there's that model of the Yankees letting guys get their feet wet in the big leagues and that turning into a successful outcome.
It's funny you bring up Schmidt, because we've asked Boone a couple times, you know, who's more confident, Warren or Schmidt? And his answer is always Michael King. So,
you know what?
They're up there. They are ultra confident in themselves, those three guys. And yeah, like, that's another thing I've observed about Will over the last 2 years, is like, he really believes in his ability. He's still just young and, you know, figuring some things out.
You know what, you have to, if you want to be a starting pitcher in New York, you got to do it, because he had like 10 starts maybe under his belt and everybody wanted him in AAA. And the same was true of Schmidt at one point. The same will be true for any starting pitcher who comes up and struggles at any point. I'm sure there will be a conversation about one of Elmer, Hester, Rodriguez. I'm sure there'll be a conversation about one of those three guys one of those three guys are bound to have like early career struggles if they come up. I'm sure the conversation of, should this guy be in AAA, does this guy suck, will come up, and we can revisit this all over again. So any final thoughts before we move on here?
No, I think that covers it on Warren.
Well, we'll stick with the bullpen, but we'll stick with the pitching conversation here. Jake Bird's throwing a new cutter, and he's one of the guys in the mix for the final bullpen spots in this team. Gary, can you talk to us a little bit about what Bird's been working on with this cutter and how his odds look to potentially make this roster?
Yeah, so after he was demoted last year, after his nightmarish introduction to life with the Yankees, he started working on a cutter at AAA, and that pitch induced a whiff percentage over 41%. So you combine that with a sweeper and a curve and a heater that already had high whiff percentages, and that's a pretty nasty arsenal coming out of the bullpen. Basically, what he did, the way he was explaining it to me, was he altered the shape of the pitch to get more ride. He also made an effort to throw it with some more velocity so that it better resembles his four-seam fastball before then darting away from hitters, especially lefties. Now, that was something the Yankees wanted him to focus on. They've also talked about him improving his command a little bit, but they love the shape of his pitches. They think his stuff is nasty, and Boone's made it pretty clear that he's going to have a real opportunity to make an impact in this bullpen. I would think of, you know, all these lottery tickets that we've discussed, he's one of the guys that has an inside track at winning one of the jobs here in spring training.
Yeah, and on the note of the Yankees thinking his stuff is nasty, this is not a Yankee-only belief. The Stuff Plus model, available on FanGraphs for free, had Jake Bird at a 117 Stuff Plus. That was 18th out of 147 qualified relievers. And to give a quick comparison on what his cutter looked like last year compared to what it's looked like this spring training, last year's cutter sat at 92.5 miles per hour with 9.2 inches of induced vertical break, which is the ride that you were talking about. This past spring training, he's up to 93.2 miles per hour, so about a half tick up, with 12.2 inches of induced vertical break, which means he's added about 3 inches of ride and about half a tick to the velocity of that cutter. So both goals to this point, it's only two outings, so very small sample size, have so far been accomplished. And I am interested to see what he looks like this year, because I was a big proponent of getting him at the deadline. It did not work at that point in time. Last year, I think it was his first game was the Miami game, where every new reliever came in and proceeded to not pitch well, for a lack of better terms, and then had a clean outing against Miami, and then had took the loss in Texas after a blown save, I believe, from Devin Williams. So, yeah, was not a strong start, but hopefully 2026, clean slate, man.
There's two other things I think that fans should keep in mind with not only him, but, you know, well, one point pertaining to him, the other point pertaining to a few players. You know, Bird was overworked by the Rockies. in the first half last year. That's something that, you know, he kind of shied away from saying directly, but Aaron Boone was very blunt and direct about. And then the other thing to keep in mind is Jake Bird, Angel Chivici, Ryan McMahon, even guys who I've all written about in the last week or so, and like, they're all coming over from the Rockies, which I don't know if casual fans realize, they were operating in like the Cretaceous period, prior to their new regime taking over. I mean, they're basically jumping into the future now when it comes to how the Yankees approach analytics, data, biomechanics, medicine, all this stuff. So the idea that maybe the Yankees could get a little more out of any of those three guys, like, it's not super far-fetched. I'm not saying, we talked about Ryan McMahon and his stance change. I'm not saying he's suddenly going to be a guy with a 115, 120 OPS. I'm not saying Chivici or Bird or something going to become elite setup men, but it's easy to see why maybe they underperformed in certain ways in Colorado, whereas now the Yankees see something where they say, like, oh, we can take that and do a whole lot more with it.
Yeah, and on the note of overworking and overuse, at the end of June, the only reliever with more innings pitched than Jake Bird was Ben Kasperius. Ben Kasperius was a starting pitcher who converted to reliever because the Dodger rotation is obviously super stacked and they didn't really have a spot for him in the rotation. He had 47 innings at that point of the season. That is a lot of work. And at that point, he had a 2.68 ERA, and then his season completely crashed and burned. I think his ERA was like, had to be over, I think it was over 7 or 8. I forget the exact mark. But yeah, things change quickly when you're getting burned. And as you mentioned with the Rockies, not an organization known for being on the cutting edge of pitching development, and also a tough place to pitch. Pitches literally move differently. You have to adjust to pitching in a ballpark where or pitching in scenarios where the ball doesn't dip as much. You have to pitch in scenarios where the ball does dip more. It's just a whole weird thing. It's kind of like what Rockies hitters deal with, where their road numbers will be so bad because the ball moves so differently than where it does at home. And then some guys have it normalized, some guys don't. It's a whole interesting conversation, but that's a different conversation for a different podcast. Gary, with Jake Bird, you mentioned that he's on the inside track. He's got one of the better shots to make this bullpen. What's the current bullpen race right now? Who do you think are the favorites to make it at this point in time? Obviously, very early.
I would think it's, like I said, Bird. And if he stays healthy and pitches relatively well, I would put Cade Winquist there at the top of the competition as well. He's a Rule 5 draft pick, so if he doesn't make the team, Yankees have to expose him to the waivers, possibly return him to the Cardinals, et cetera, et cetera. They like his stuff. He's got really good stuff. It grades out very well. He's added a sinker this spring as well. So they're probably going to give him every opportunity to make the team, just because that's another quality arm that you are maintaining on your depth chart. Some of these other guys, Brent Hedrick, Gary De Los Santos, even Bird himself, like, they have options. So you can stash them away in AAA, whereas Winquist, it's kind of take it or leave it, right? So I think just for the sake of maintaining roster flexibility, that probably gives him an edge.
Yeah, and that is important. It is important to note that, look, I love Brent Hedrick, for example, and I would love to see him make this team, but he's got minor league options. That's kind of going to work against him versus Winquist, where it's, all right, you put him on the roster or he's no longer in your organization. So these things do matter. They have to matter, because in a perfect world, they have a roster logjam. In the real world, they're going to have somebody get hurt, and this entire conversation about roster spots are going to be irrelevant. Enough people get hurt during the year where this always happens. There's always a point in time where it's like, oh man, they don't have enough spots for these guys. Who's getting sent down? And then boom, this guy's shoulder hurts. Now they've got a roster spot. It's always how it goes. It's pitching, man. It's pitching. Any other notes you have about the bullpen?
Yeah, I would just think, like you said, injuries are going to happen. It's going to throw off these projections or something. But right now, you look at the rotation and the bullpen altogether, right? Because you've got Ryan Yarbrough in there, right? So right now, Yarbrough is a swingman, but he would be in the bullpen. That gives you two lefties alongside Tim Hill. So probably that means Brent Hedrick is starting the year at AAA, right? a guy like CVG, like we talked about, he has things to work on. He's more of a project. He has options and only 1 year service time. So, you know, he could be a guy that goes to AAA, works on some things, tweaks some things, proves that, you know, he can command the ball, that he can get some whiff rate, which is something the Yankees want to see out of him. So all things to kind of keep in mind. You know, you got to think about optionality. You got to think about lefty versus righty. You got to think about what the rotation currently looks like versus what it could look like if there's an injury. All that stuff is playing into the equation here.
Yeah, and it's not like there aren't avenues to, like, make the roster move around if needed. In the scenario where Jake Bird isn't effective, he'll get optioned. He's got options. In the world where Paul Blackburn is both ineffective and not needed because the rotation magically stayed healthy and guys like Rodon and Cole are back and guys are still healthy, which would be a miracle, probably not going to happen. Then maybe Paul Blackburn not pitching well would get him cut. He's only making $2 million. It's not like they've never absorbed $2 million before. So there are avenues for them to create roster spots if the bullpen demands it. It's not as if they don't move the bullpen around or teams don't have to move their bullpen around. Guys getting overworked. I remember Hedrick last year got sent down because he was used so much and they needed a fresh arm up there. Things change. Things are going to change pretty rapidly, especially in April. I mean, the ramp up period again in March, all these things are going to create avenues for the bullpen to change. So I think that we'll keep our eyes on the bullpen because the conversation is always going to come up given how much volatility seems to exist with this group. But that seems to be the latest there and the kind of the current standing of that unit. Now, there are a couple of new tweaks to baseball right now. I don't know if you have anything else you want to add with the bullpen before I wrap here.
No,
yeah, so there. There is one new, I guess you could put rule change. Yeah, rule change. There we go. ABS, automatic ball strike system. Teams are going to be allowed to challenge twice. You can challenge by simply tapping the top of your head. The hitter, catcher, and pitcher all have the ability to do so. Aaron Boone mentioned that the Yankees are going to be pretty aggressive with this, and Gary saw a lot of challenges today. Why are the Yankees so aggressive with it? What's the benefit? Is this just like a screw it, let's play around thing, or is there something to gain from this informationally?
So, first part of your question, like, the Yankees have always preached, you know, that they're really good at controlling the strike zone, right? Like, that goes all the way back to Savages in the Box. So, this, in their mind, is something where they have an inherent advantage because they feel like they have a really good understanding of the strike zone. They feel like their lineup is full of guys who are really disciplined. And yeah, they're going to be aggressive with it. We saw that today. I forget exactly how many there were. I want to say the Yankees challenged like 7 or 8 times and won all but one of them. It's a lot. But what they're doing right now is being super aggressive with it in spring training because they're still gathering information. They're still trying to figure out, okay, which of our hitters are the best at this? Do we trust all of them? Do we trust our pitchers to do it? Do we trust our catchers to do it? I think as we get closer toward the end of spring training and certainly into the regular season, that we're going to see them have a more strategic approach to this. Right now, it's more like, hey, let's go crazy and see what happens and see what we learn. And Boone was even saying today that the Yankees' approach to it in April might not be the same as it is in July, might not be the same as it is in October, right? So they're still in the process of gathering information. That process actually began like before ABS was even implemented in Major League games or was announced that it was going to be. You know, that they've been studying this for, you know, at least a year now, I think Boone said, maybe two. So they have an idea of who has historically gotten screwed on what types of pitches, what, you know, certain locations in the zones, things like that. Obviously, Aaron Judge is a guy who has been victimized by calls below the strike zone. Something interesting that I thought Boone said earlier this spring was that Jazz Chisholm Jr. is a guy who has really gotten screwed with incorrect calls at the top of the strike zone. So, you know, I think some Yankee fans might be assuming like, oh, Jazz is a guy that should not be trusted to make challenges. It sounds like on certain types of pitches, certain types of situations, he will be.
Yeah, and a couple of interesting things that you mentioned there when it comes to like the right kind of guys doesn't always come down to plate discipline or like perceived understanding of the strike zone, but Also, how often do you get screwed, for lack of better terms? I pulled up this stat from Baseball Savant. The most called strikes out of the strike zone this past season. Number one, the Angels. Number two, the Yankees. Imagine, again, Judge is a big, literally and figuratively, reason for that, given just how consistent the low strike has been called against him. Gary, I got to ask you personally, though. Obviously, you know, there's strategic things to it. There's there's a lot of other conversations we have with it. But in your opinion, are you an ABS guy? Or are you not an ABS guy?
I'm honestly not. I haven't been since we started seeing it, you know, in spring training games last year. I know that the challenges do not take all that long, like in the grand scheme of things. I just don't love the starting and stopping and starting and stopping. You know, today it was I believe a minor league umpire behind the plate, and you know, on one hand it's like, all right, like this guy's obviously not ready for the majors. On the other hand, it just got to the point where it's like, okay, this is a spring training game and this guy is just getting humiliated. I think maybe I'll become more of a fan of it as the Yankees become a little more strategic with it. So far this spring, just like challenge. I don't love it, but that's just my opinion.
And look, I think it's one of those things where, unlike the pitch clock, it's not designed for the fan, I think, because if it was designed for the fan to get like a full-on, okay, we're going to be more accurate, I think you would just have a full like automated zone at that point if it was about... Like, I don't think this is about fan enjoyment or like even like viewer enjoyment or whatever. I think this is strictly like a player thing. So I'm not sure. Like, I don't think the viewing experience is better either.
I think it's a middle ground for the players and the umpires. You know?
Yeah.
I don't think Major League Baseball just wanted to get rid of home plate umpires, right? And you know, they have a union. They have things that they fight for and bargain for as well. You know, players obviously want more accurate calls, but I'm not sure that people realize like how accurate the modern day umpire is and how hard of a job it is compared to now. Like think about a hitter, right? Hitters talk all the time about how pitching is better than it's ever been before because of velocity, spin, break, etc. Like it's kind of the same perspective for the umpires trying to call these pitches as well. So it's not an easy job. I think more often than not, they do a really good job of it. Today was not a good example, but again, a minor league umpire. That the problem is that when an ump has a bad game or makes a bad call in a big spot, like that's what gets talked about. That's when suddenly we're talking about the umpires. Nobody's ever, you know, losing their minds on Twitter or social media because, wow, that ump was so freaking good today, right? It's like he goes unnoticed. So that's partly, I think, why we are where we're at.
The one umpire who I think I did do that for is Pat Hoberg, and then he got caught up in gambling. So great, awesome, incredible. And I do think when it comes to, like, you mentioned, like, middle ground and the umpire union, it is important to note, like, precedent does matter. You take away the home plate umpire, what's next? We have, like, foul lines where we put, like, a chip in the ball and... Yes, no, the ball sense, like we get feedback and we can get more accurate, fair foul calls. Do we, like, how does, what else?
I also like having some human element to the game. You know, yes, you want every call to be correct, but that's not the way the game's ever been, right? Like sometimes an umpire changes an at-bat. Sometimes an umpire changes an approach. Sometimes a guy needs to protect the plate, which I think, you know, baseball has gotten more and more away from over the years. Not to sound like some old man on a soapbox here, but like, you know, there's a little gamesmanship that comes along with the human element, and I don't want to see all of that taken out of baseball.
I don't want to see framing go. I really don't. I don't want catchers.
That too.
Like that is.
I don't think it will because like you can still lose challenges at a certain point, but it does affect it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, more so in the sense that I don't want it to ever go fully automated because I don't want to lose framing. I think framing is cool. Like, I think it's great. Like, catchers, then suddenly catchers are throwers and blockers, which the league doesn't value that much. Like, not saying they don't value it at all, but not as much as framing. And they still get beat up, and the physical toll doesn't change at all. So you just have guys who are getting beat up behind home plate, and you're kind of hoping they can hit enough to carry their weight. Like, I feel like that just suddenly becomes a very boring position compared to where it is today. But that's a whole other conversation. Gary, any final thoughts you have on ABS?
Nah, I think that's good for now. Well, like the Yankees strategy, maybe my thoughts will evolve as the season goes on.
I don't think this is the last time we're going to be talking about ABS. So, well, throughout the season, I think this will be a conversation that will continue.
You know what I'm terrified of is a game that's a close, tight game, and it ends on an ABS challenge, and I've written my game story because I have to final out right on deadline, and like, okay, now there's an ABS challenge, and I'm rewriting things like that. I'm not looking forward to that headache.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like I think pitch clock violation was a lot of fear around like a game being decided on a pitch clock violation. I think that's a little bit different. This actually like could, if it's the last play of the game, you should use your challenge if you have one. Regardless.
You might as well, right? Yeah, you might
like,
as well.
It's like challenging like a bang bang play at first that's kind of clearly out or safe. It's like, shit, dude, it's got nothing to lose, right?
Right, exactly.
So we are going to see a lot of that. We'll talk a little bit now about kind of the behind the scenes, kind of inside being through the first 2 weeks of spring training. Gary, as a beat writer, what's the experience been like? Kind of talk to us about some of the things that's been going on your end.
Yeah, so like I said, been dealing with a cold. A couple of us here on the beat have been doing that, but it's been pretty good otherwise, you know, up until today, and I'm not complaining because I know there's snow back in New York, but you know, we had really nice warm weather up until today or yesterday, so that's been nice to enjoy. Trying to get as much work as I can, you know, get done as possible. It's been a little lackluster as far as accessibility and player availability in the Yankees clubhouse. Yeah, I think a little light compared to spring trainings in the past, but you make do with what you got. You get who you can get. There was a sewage disruption at George M. Steinbrenner Field earlier this week or last week. Not the first time I've had to deal with fecal matter and stinky water at George M. Steinbrenner Field, believe it or not. So that was pretty interesting to deal with and write about, actually. It made for a funny story, I thought. And last night actually was our annual dinner with Aaron Boone and the coaching staff. For those that don't know, every year the beat writers and Boone and typically his new coaches on staff, we get together, we have a dinner, we alternate every year who pays for it, the writers versus the team. It's a good time, good way to get FaceTime with Boone, get FaceTime with the new coaches as well. In a non-professional, you know, non-work, non-high-stakes situation, I think it's a good thing for just building rapport, getting to know guys. You learn things about their families, where they went to school, and vice versa. You know, questions are asked of us. We get to share a little bit about our lives. It reminds everybody, like, hey, we're all humans here.
Yeah, and I think it's cool. I think it sounds sick, but I gotta ask a couple questions about this. The first one.
Yeah, what do we got?
So who pays?
So this time around, it was the Yankees' turn to pay, and that is the Yankees organization. This isn't coming out of Boone's pocket or anything like that. Last year, it was our turn to pay. They actually ran up a pretty nice bill for, you know, our companies are also paying for this, but we're not as well funded, you know, at the Daily News or some other publications as the New York Yankees might be. So they ran up a pretty good tab, and yeah, we made sure to get them back last night and outdo ourselves. I will say that is a war that we cannot win in the long term, but the temporary victory feels good. I had a nice Wagyu ribeye steak, so that's the first time I've ever ordered a full Wagyu steak out before. Had a couple nice glasses of wine. Would have liked to have done a little more, if not for the cold meds. But it was a good time, and yeah. Well, hopefully we can call a truce going forward as far as the high tabs go.
Yeah, hopefully, and I will say, dude, there's nothing better than a good cut of steak. I'm a steak. I love steak, man. There's nothing. If there is one meal I could eat for dinner every single day, it'd be like doesn't have to be like something crazy fancy, just a solid piece of steak. Could do it every single day for the rest of my life.
That's my go-to. That's nothing better than a good steak.
So reliable. And I can say now on the podcast with a good wine, excuse me. Love it. Now, one other question I did have about, you know, your experience so far at spring training. There are days where you're at GMS watching live bullpens while there are games going on in Yankee Stadium. Can you kind of talk about that? Like, what? Why do some riders stay back? What's kind of the benefit, or I guess the curiosity behind that? I'm just curious. That's all.
You mean while there's games going on the road?
Let's say the Yankees are in Dunedin or Sarasota. Like Dunedin today, Sarasota, they played the first game. Why do some guys tend to hang back and check what's going on at GMS?
Yeah, so as I'm sure fans notice, like very rarely do the star players, the big-name players, make road trips that are beyond 30, 40 minutes. You know, today was Dunedin, so that's about 45 minutes away. Aaron Judge, Cody Bellinger, Trent Grisham, a bunch of other, you know, regulars went and made that trip. They're not necessarily going to Sarasota. They're not going to Fort Myers. They're not going to the East Coast, you know, when the Yankees go play the Marlins or the Cardinals, whoever's out there. So sometimes it's more beneficial for a beat writer to hang back at GMS. And, you know, you hope that in a quieter locker room with fewer reporters around, because some reporters do go to every single game, you know, you're hoping that you can get an Aaron Judge one-on-one. You're hoping that you could get a long interview, you know, that maybe is more than 5-10 minutes with somebody that you need for a feature story that you want to do or that you want to work on. You know, the other day, Garrett Cole threw to live hitters for the first time when the Yankees were, I believe, going to Sarasota that day. To me, that's the story of the day, right? Let's hang back at GMS instead of watching a game that does not count and does not matter and is mostly full of backups and minor league players. So that's the logic that goes into that. There are beat reporters that go to every game. Some guys believe that, you know, go wherever the manager goes, you know, Aaron Boone. So difference in philosophy, difference in approach. Sometimes it depends on, you know, what you need that day. Do you know that you've worked ahead and can fill space in a physical paper? You know, that's something that I have to worry about all the time. A game is always a guaranteed way to have something, but if you work ahead and you want to go pursue a feature story, or you know you can get something in the clubhouse that day or from being at GMS that day, such as a Garrett Cole, you know, live BP session, then, you know, you do that. And as an added benefit, you know, typically the workout days are shorter when there's a game going on elsewhere, so you get a little bit of an earlier day as well.
Yeah, so I think it's I think that's fascinating. I've always like kind of wondered why, because I've always thought like they're getting a live bullpen feed in, like there's a game going on. How the hell are they doing that? So I do find that fascinating. I think it's a good point too of like, you know, kind of go where the story goes. If the story's at home and, you know, the story's best at home, like there's like the Garrett Cole situation that happening on the day of the spring opener. I can speak for myself. Maybe some people at home feel differently. I liked seeing Elmer pitch. It was super cool. Definitely cared a lot more about the Garrett Cole thing. Definitely saw seeing Garrett Cole's velocity. I was like, I got to talk about this for as long as I possibly can.
And it doesn't always work out. And sometimes it's also a game time decision. For example, for both of those situations, when Cole was facing live hitters, we didn't know he was going to be doing that until we got there that day. So some people decided right then and there in morning clubhouse, because you still get morning clubhouse at GMS even when there's a road game. Some people decided right then and there, oh, okay, I should stay here today instead of going to Sarasota. So that's a game time decision example. Yesterday, I decided to hang back. Turned out the clubhouse at GMS was still pretty empty and I didn't accomplish all that much. Luckily, I had something in the chamber that I was able to file for this morning. Still had a story to go, you know, ready to rock. Still able to fill that physical space in the newspaper. You know, sometimes it's a gamble. Sometimes it's an educated guess. Sometimes the Yankees make the decision for you and they tell you Gary Cole's pitching that day.
Yeah, and look, you know, Gary always prepared, always locked and loaded. Got to stay sharp, man. I love that. Any final notes? Any other interesting things from this past week?
No, I'll just add that this is my last night here in the Airbnb that me and Chris Kirshner and Brendan Cuddy are sharing. I fly back home to New York tomorrow night, so I will get some clubhouse time in at GMS. I will not be sticking around for the game. But yeah, then I'm back home for a little while. I come back down to spring training March 16th through the 22nd. Won't be going to Arizona when the Yankees stop there for the end of their exhibition schedule, but I will be then looking forward to opening day in San Francisco and, you know, hopping on a flight to Seattle after that. And yeah, we're almost off and running.
You know, it's curious. I'm actually going to be down there the 16th to the 22nd. That's my exact leave and return, get there and return date. That's crazy.
Might have to do a live in the same room podcast.
Hell yeah. And I'm not in school, which is great. Like, that's my spring break. Last year, I had like three classes left before spring break while I was in Tampa. And luckily, some of them were Zoom. So I was just in a Zoom out of the Heinz Field complex after like the minor leaguers played. And I'm just sitting in the vast parking lot. I don't know if you've ever seen that just big ass parking lot that's there between like the entrance and
we had to park there the other day because of the sewage. Right. The sewage issue forced the Yankees to hold their workout in the morning at Heims, and me and another rider actually initially parked behind the main field fence, and they're taking BP, and all of a sudden Judge and Grisham and Bellinger are launching balls beyond the scoreboard, and I was like, let's run out there and go park way out there and way beyond center field. And that was a smart move.
Good decision. Good call. Yeah. I was taking a Zoom class out there for one of the days last year. I was just standing there like, where are you? I'm like, in the middle of a field in Florida. So hell yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good note to end on. Good note to end talking about Heinz Field. I enjoyed going there for the first time in my life last year. It was cool. Hopefully, you don't have to be there again because of sewage-related reasons. Hopefully, next time you're there, it's intentional.
Fingers crossed. But
yeah, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. It's happened twice. You know, strike three? Three out of three? I mean, three is a more even. I think three is a cleaner number than two. But maybe for the topic, number two is the better number. But we appreciate you guys tuning in and listening to our seventh episode of the Bronx Beat. We appreciate all the support you guys have given us to this point. And if this is your first time listening, well, we've got a good catalog of episodes you can catch up on in the playlist that this is in. You guys can check this out on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, really wherever you get your podcasts. If you're watching on YouTube, like, subscribe. If you're listening on audio, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and download as well. Links to all the articles that Gary discussed in this video will be in the description below, as will a link to the New York Daily News segment where you can just kind of go through all of his articles and go through there and see some of his work. Yeah, we really appreciate it, guys. We'll see you guys in the next one. Have a great rest of your day or night. Stay safe, stay warm if you're in the Northeast. And yeah, peace out, everybody.
Thanks, guys, and stay warm.